Welcome back to Half Past Capitalism, where we talk about alternatives to capitalism as if they were possible. This show is indeed part of the Harbinger Media Network. Chris Gilbert has been living in Caracas, Venezuela, since 2006, and he's a professor of political science at the Universidad Bolivariana de Venezuela. He's also a co-author of Venezuela, The Present as Struggle, Voices from the Bolivarian Revolution. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Drew. Happy to be here.
So today we're talking about Venezuela, which of course has been enduring a long economic and social crisis, notably due to the U.S. sanctions on that country, which have had a devastating social and economic impacts. And I think we'll get into that a little bit later. And certainly Venezuela, I think, has become sort of synonymous with a sort of a right wing taunt. Basically, you have people say, like, if you want socialism, go live in Venezuela, as if that's like horrible. But yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the real efforts to build socialism in Venezuela, which are of course multifaceted and in many cases extremely inspiring. So yeah, thanks for joining me, Chris. And I guess I want to start by saying, I'm not sure people have really any idea what the word commune means in Venezuela and the Venezuelan context. In North America, it means, you kind of conjures up images of a bunch of hippies getting together and farming together. But in Venezuela, I think the scale and the sort of range of productive activities that happen in the context of a commune are very different. So if we could just start by talking about, what is it like to experience, you've visited several communes in Venezuela. What is it like to experience visiting a commune? What do you see? What do you hear?
Sure. I think it's pretty important that we return to the question of sanctions at the end, but we'll do that in due time. And also the question about the taunt. I think the taunt is quite unfair, especially in the context of sanctions, and especially in a highly unequal global context in which people, when they think about the problems of socialism in Venezuela, they often compare the situation with Sweden or something without taking into account the vast differences in wealth and the elephant in the room, which is imperialism, which has continually suctioned value and destroyed economic activity in the global south. With devastating, lethal consequences in many places, as is happening right now in Venezuela. With regard to what the nature of the communes in Venezuela, I think you're right about the scale, for sure, and also the class basis. I think many of the communal experiments that took place in the United States, you mentioned hippie communes, those were really quite admirable undertakings in many cases. Nevertheless, they were confined quite often to a middle class sector. And another important difference, not only the scale, the class nature, but also the fact that the Venezuelan communes are part of a larger movement of both the Bolivarian process, the Bolivarian Revolution, that has a clearly defined goal of complete transformation of society, of building socialism in the 21st century, as Chavez said. So those things mark an important difference. And in some sense, that's a very positive context, in spite of all the difficulties here for building socialism. There's been a long process of education over the past 20 or more years, and education through practice, which is the most valuable kind of education, and a very interesting series of theoretical reflections, which to me, I find is often one of the more ignored sections of the aspects of the Bolivarian process. Imagine Hugo Chavez, delving into some of the most advanced Marxist theory of his time, and also his capacity to respond to popular demands, to establish a kind of dialectical relationship with the masses. As far as the concrete nature of what one sees in the communes here, and it's true that I've been carrying out together with Ciro Pascual Marquina, an investigation over the past 2 years of different communes in the country in an effort to understand the movement. But as far as what you encounter, often you could say visually it's quite quite unimpressive, to put it that way, because what you encounter in a commune is, for example, the best known commune in the country, probably internationally, is called El Maizal. It's a rural commune about 4 hours from Caracas. And what you see there is what it is, or what it was in great measure. It was a privately owned farm that was occupied by a group of people in the area and then converted into a productive unit for the El Maizal commune. When I think about the communes and what you see in them, I often think of what Bertolt Brecht said about a factory. He said you couldn't tell from a photograph, you couldn't tell a socialist factory from a capitalist factory. In some measure, that's true of communes. You can't see the most important thing, which is the new social relations that are emerging in the communes, new, more egalitarian social relations, less alienated forms of production that are really the centerpiece of communes. I think one of the most interesting things, though, is the effort to symbolize or to make visible or to discover a symbolic or discursive register that will signal to the people in the commune and those outside that the whole project is directed towards socialism is building something new. And that's something maybe we could talk about further on. I think it's one of the more interesting things in communal development here, and it's part of a lot of practices of popular power in Latin America.
Yeah, so I'd like to understand, I mean, my understanding is that Venezuelan communes are sort of all over the country and a lot of the different regions. Some areas in sort of heavily indigenous populated regions, in other areas, and with different kind of biomes as well. You have the sort of low-lying areas, you have the mountains. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, the variety of the communes, but also what kinds of things are they producing? Like, what are they doing, and what is the sort of tangible positive impact that has on people's lives in the area?
Sure, you're absolutely right. The communes are quite varied. One of the distinctive features here is that it is unlike, I believe, in many other countries, there's actually a legal framework. There's a set of laws. I have a copy of them here. There are five laws that were developed in 2010 about laws of popular power and the laws of how to build a commune and how to build a communal economy. They're extraordinarily ambitious. But that being said, the fact that there are laws and that Hugo Chavez in 2009, it'd be interesting for us to go back to the way that Chavez and the Venezuelan people together arrived at the idea of the commune. But the fact that he in 2009 declared or asked rather, and that's important for his kind of leadership, encouraged people to form communes. So there was this opening towards communes. Nevertheless, one of the most important things about communes is that the Venezuelan communes, they are initiatives from below, and that means they'll be very varied. Varied in response to the train and in response to the social demographic conditions they encounter. The successful ones even more so. The successful ones are the ones that have encountered creative solutions to the different problems they face. So for example, one of the communes we visited about a year ago is the Che Guevara commune, which is in the foothills of the Andes. And there was a coffee processing cooperative that was developed maybe 12 years ago, and then it kind of disappeared. It still maintained, it was kind of in hibernation. And then when Chavez called for the construction of communes that socialism would be built with communes as its basic cell, then those people involved in the cooperative organized around the coffee cooperative, making that the center of their commune. So that was one solution. Another interesting project, maybe the most famous commune in Venezuela, is El Maizal, which is in a plains region of Venezuela and mainly grows corn, as the name indicates. And they also have a large scale cattle production, cattle raising. And that commune arrived, came to exist because a group of people, one of whom was a former security guard on the farm, decided to occupy a private farm there. And they actually did it. This is interesting. Two of the most successful communes in Venezuela actually got going as communes before Chavez made the public statement to that effect in 2009. So they'd actually started to build a commune before Chavez. It was kind of a happy coincidence before Chavez started talking about communes. And maybe the most powerful urban commune in the country actually got going as a commune. And this is interesting. I don't exactly know. I have some ideas about how they got to be building a commune before, almost 3 years before Chavez made the public statement on television. And that's El Panal, which means the beehive in Caracas. That's a fascinating experience, extremely powerful in terms of its levels of organization They maintain a number of different productive units, including a textile workshop. They grow pigs inside an urban deep bed pig pens, and they do fish farming. And that's actually just a few metro stops from where I live here. So you're right, there's a great variety. And that has a lot to do with it being in great measure, a grassroots project that coincides with a legal political framework that is provided through a set of laws and through political discourse.
You mentioned the sort of process of how co-ops emerged from, I guess, some kind of like a dialogue and a revolutionary process that was certainly had Chavez as like a major actor, but also had sort of movements from below that were sort of moving into the space created by the change in leadership in Venezuela. Can you talk about the inception of communes and sort of what are the sort of founding principles of this kind of movement?
Sure, I think it's hard to, with any historical occurrence, it's always hard to know how far to go back. Maybe I'd like to start in the 1990s. In the 1990s, there was already in the decade in which there was a giant social crisis in the country, having to do with the implementation of neoliberal reforms in 1989, that kind of hit the world news when people rebelled in that same year, forming what's called the Caracaso. But the popular movements in that time, they started to, and the movements of opposition at that time were fascinating projects that really did wager for popular power, different forms of even community control. And that actually entered into Chavez's program. It's known worldwide that Chavez attempted to take power unsuccessfully in 1992. And then he was put in prison and started to develop programs. Chavez was a much more programmatic and theoretically minded person than he's often given credit for. But some of those very early programs started to call for popular power, participative and protagonistic democracy. And so I think that, and many other people think, that the seed of the commune got started right then, because there was a understanding that, as we often say in Latin America, only the people can save the people, that it's only through participative popular democracy that people can affect a transformation. They have to be the subjects, they can't be the predicates of change. And so I would think that the gradual unfolding of the Bolivarian process, Chavez managed to take power through electoral means in 1999, or actually 1998. But the whole unfolding of the Bolivarian process was in some way a highly creative search full of interesting experiments to obtain social emancipation or complete human emancipation through profoundly democratic means. So as you pointed out, one of the first attempts to, on an economic front, to build a kind of economic democracy was cooperatives. And that project I think took shape around 2004. Then another interesting episode was the community councils. So if you take the cooperative project was pretty much an economic project. And then the community councils were actually formed the following year, 2005. And they were essentially kind of neighborhood forms of self-government. Then in 2006, after a kind of push and pull with imperialism that expressed itself in a right-wing coup against Chavez, and also in an oil sabotage, essentially the oil business was already in principle a national business, but the leadership of PDVSA, the national oil company, actually shut down the business. It was kind of a boss's strike that really had a devastating impact on the country. And that's when Chavez began to radicalize. And he declared, the whole process to be anti-imperialist around 2004. And then in 2006, he declared that it would be a socialist project. There was an interesting kind of turn of brilliant. Chavez was a great speaker. It was in Argentina that he said, another world is possible if it's socialist, or that other world is possible and it's called socialism. He decided it was important to give a name to the alternative world. It was, of course, in response to the slogan of the World Social Forum. And the communes emerge somewhat later, but there's an intermediate step, which is after about 2006, there was a whole episode of trying to build kind of state-run or different kinds of state-run industries that were in principle socialist enterprises. They were in principle social regimes of social property. So when I try to present how Chavez and the Venezuelan people together arrived at the idea of building communes, I often like to present it as a kind of schema. On the one hand, they'd already tried cooperatives, and the cooperatives experienced numerous difficulties. You could say, and I don't mean to be overly dismissive, I understand that cooperatives can be very useful in a socialist transition, and Lenin himself said so. But it's true also that in a legal sense, a cooperative is potentially merely a form of private property. It's a form of collective private property, but it is still private property. And I say that on a theoretical level, but on a practical level, you could see how many of the cooperatives in Venezuela, on the one hand, just existed on paper, and actually were ordinary capitalist businesses hiding behind the laws of cooperatives. But even the cooperatives that were real were often subordinated to simply subcontracted by other larger businesses, and they ended up being exploited by those other businesses, and people lived in poor conditions. I think it was some recognition of both the practical problems and the theoretical problems that encouraged Chavez to move away from that and kind of move the pendulum in the opposite direction with state-run enterprises. Even though the state-run enterprises were generally called co-gestion, co-management, they tried to involve the community too. If someone wants to see something, there's an interesting film made by a German and Austrian called Five Factories that takes you around some of those projects, and they were actually quite fascinating. But those, as people who know the history of cooperatives well and have a commitment to popular power wouldn't be surprised to know, those businesses often fell into kinds of bureaucratism. Workers lost interest. They didn't identify with the businesses. And so I think at that point, Chavez was trying to find something that would solve those two problems. On the one hand, the failure of the cooperatives, and on the other hand, the failure of the very limited success of the state-managed factories. And so that's where the commune comes in. I think another thing we could talk about is also the theoretical element, because Chavez also immersed himself in established a relationship since the 1990s with a fascinating Hungarian Marxist named István Mészáros, who was one of the proponents of what he called the communal system as an alternative to capitalism.
So yeah, I'd love to hear more about that. What distinguishes a commune from like a big co-op or a commune from a state-run enterprise? Like what is the sort of defining characteristic in the Venezuelan context in particular?
Sure. I mean, as against a cooperative, one important thing of the Venezuelan communes is that they're both political and economic entities. They combine, communes are made by combining community councils. So the community councils are already instances of local government. And then they attempt to develop means of production that are under a regime of social property. To say something fairly obvious, the difference between a state-run national socialist, national, socialist enterprise is that it's under worker control. The work is self-managed. But I think that one of the most important ways of understanding the difference between a commune and a cooperative and what social property means in the former case, in the case of a commune, is that the commune does not just try to produce for the benefit of the people involved in it. It has to have a wider social horizon. And part of that has to do with ideally it will try to establish non-commodity relations with the broader society. But at the very least, it will take the surplus and attempt to find a social, all Venezuelan communes talk about their surplus and what they do with their surplus and try to direct it towards social ends in the community. So I think that one of the most important differences between a cooperative and a commune in the Venezuelan context is that with the communes, there's a clear sense in which the communes are, their social property is directed not in the terms of the sense in which their social property is not in terms of a narrowly defined collective, though that is the base of the commune. There is a defined base of the commune, but they try to reach to the broader society. They try to produce the notion of social property is social property directed towards the whole society.
my understanding is that communal councils in Venezuela were these sort of basically at the level of like a neighborhood type unit, you would, the state would sort of encourage people to sort of get together and create these sort of direct democratic management structures that would undertake projects in a local area. So whether it's like renovating an elevator in an apartment building or creating some kind of community center or whatever it was. So that is already like a concept that's foreign to most people in North America. So could you describe a little bit the communal council process, and then how those communal councils would create sort of sort of this communal property that tries to have not non-commodified relation, like economic relations with the rest of society?
Sure. The community councils were, you know, groups of families that were brought together in a given territory. Some cases people attempted to form community councils, consejos comunales, in workers and university contexts. I actually participated in the attempt to form one in the university where I worked. I'm currently part of a community council here, though it's actually in the towers where I live, it's not very active. Previously, I was in a community council in a different neighborhood that actually did actually function. They usually bring together, I think in the rural areas, fewer people, but I think there were about 200 to 300 families in the community council that I lived in which I was a member in La Pastora some 5 years ago. Then when it comes to making communes are usually groups of like 10 to 20 community councils. And then there's often the search for some way in which they can find a productive or economic base. A lot of times, actually, this is a result of something I've seen in my research. A lot of times it involved recovering cooperatives that existed in the region or trying to incorporate cooperatives into the framework of the community council, of the newly formed commune that was and bring that under a social regime. As far as the attempt to, you know, it's important to point out that these communes are currently in a state of transition. To say that they've overcome the commodity, overcome the, you know, production condition of producing commodities would be a vast overstatement. At best, there's been an index of separation from commodity production with the effort to produce use values more that are directed towards the community and to an attempt to offer things, either some things completely freely to the community and some things at more, what is called here, solidarious prices. I think as far as the most exciting thing about the communes is the presence of a non-alienated set of social relations. To appeal a little bit to the theory that Esteban Massaros developed, perhaps we shouldn't go too deeply into it, but one thing that Esteban Massaros discovered was that he started to talk about what he called the capital system rather than capitalism. And he just thought that the capital system was a kind of social metabolism that reached in a more capillary manner into our whole society. And it could actually, this is one of the practical or historical consequences of his discovery, was that you could have a capital system that wasn't a capitalist system. And the clear case of that was a Soviet system. He felt that the Soviet system continued to maintain features of what he called the metabolism, the social metabolism of capital, even though it wasn't a strictly capitalist system. There were no capitalists in the Soviet Union, and the means of production were not private. Nevertheless, there was a vertical command over labor and a set of other features that he associated with the capital system. The key features of the capital system would be alienated means of production. It would be imposed production goals. It would be surplus labor extracted from workers who don't control their work conditions. And then there are broader societal impacts, such as certain organizations of families, which change over time. And there's the imposition of the money form, and also certain state formations emerge with the capital system. So the commune is an attempt to overcome that. And most centrally, to say it in a few words, the effort is to bring democratic control, a democratic metabolism, a substantively democratic control over production processes and also over social relations more generally. One thing that I think is worth pointing out is that this sense that the forms of domination reach more broadly than the wage relation. I think that idea, even for people who might be unfamiliar with Masseros' thinking, which would be almost everybody, they would see that corroborated through different developments in revolutionary Marxist and revolutionary theory in recent decades. On the one hand, there's a broad sense that obviously forms of gender, race, caste, forms of domination are fundamental in our societies, and that they're connected with the domination of the capital system introduces. On the other hand, you can take theorists, I'm not particularly fond of Jason Moore's thinking, but he does have an interesting idea of how, on the one hand, there's the law of value, on the other hand, there's a wider sphere of value relations. And I do think that developments in social reproduction theory point to how people are dominated not only in the workplace, but also there's forms of oppression and domination that are played out in the sphere of non-paid labor, such as care work and the raising of people, and the production of the labor force, and which usually takes place in a domestic context, is usually carried out by women. So you have this, basically, I think there's a wide theoretical consensus that the forms of domination in our society reach far beyond the wage relation. And one of the virtues of the commune is that it holds the promise of overcoming all these forms of oppression. In a Venezuelan commune, not only are the means of production and under social community control, which means that people decide what can be produced, decide how it will be produced, and they decide to do what to do with the product and what to do with the excedent. They decide, or the surplus rather, they decide what to do through different assemblies and democratic processes. But also there's a general form of self-government that happens in these communities. And that's where the other forms of oppression and the other forms of social domination that are expressed in our society can be transformed. I think that's one of the most fascinating promises that communes offer. And I would like to pose to people who reject communal organizing precisely how they would think about what organizational format they think those forms of oppression can be overcome. So on the one hand, I think there's a fascinating promise embodied in Venezuelan communes, far from being carried through to completion. It's just incipient. On the other hand, I think there's an open question about other forms of approaching socialism, whether it's workerist or whether it's a strictly or narrowly workerist one, or a state-run, a state-directed, or excessively vanguardist form approach to social transformation. It would be, I think the burden of proof is somewhat in their court to explain how they're going to, through what organizational formats, through what process, through what form of internal democracy they pose to overcome these oppressions.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, you have the sort of Soviet model where it's like, okay, we have a central, very highly centralized state that sort of runs everything and then sort of delegates down to sort of a regional level. And then eventually people, you know, workers get to have some kind of, you know, maybe they have to have some kind of say in their system, but the main decisions are sort of being made for the top down. And then you have the sort of Yugoslavian model, which is similar, but with like more participatory sort of decision-making at the level of the workplace. But then you have if I'm understanding correctly, the commune model, which basically flips it all upside down and says, okay, we're going to start with, you know, families and community sort of relationships. And then we're going to put those together in the context of sort of transformative mutual aid and also sort of decommodification of the basic economic unit that's happening at that sort of like super local level. And then we're sort of build up from there. At the same time, it's obviously Venezuela's never rejected like any top-down measures, but you have the sort of you have this process that's distinctly from below. I can imagine that all kinds of contradictions would arise there, especially if you start talking about like gender relations or different things, you know, that happen in the family unit or that happen at the level of the communal council, for example. Can you talk, I guess, first of all, is that sort of reversal of the direction from which the sort of collectivization happens, is that a correct sort of description of what you sort of see in Venezuela? And then I guess, yeah, can you talk a little bit about how that plays out?
Yeah, on the one hand, it's true that you say there's an essential direction from below to above, and essentially there's a focus on grassroots organization. one of the things that I'm used to do, when, especially when I talk to people in the Global North, is defending participation, defending popular power, faced with maybe more top-down vanguardist proposals. In your case, it's probably the opposite. I think you have a real commitment, and you're more just as important would be your audience to cooperatives, to self-organization. But I think it's also important to point out that the Venezuelan process and also proposes to hegemonize the whole society. And it also has a possibility of doing so because it's part of a sweeping mass movement that has take that, you know, there has been a taking of power and a partial transformation of the state in a way that opens parts of the state to be more sympathetic with popular power. So on the one hand, I think it's of course it's true that the kind of Esteban Mazares himself referred to these locally organized communities as kind of our Archimedean point through which organization could begin. And he thought they were highly irreversible. And I think that's true. Anyone who saw the Soviet, who witnessed, I actually lived, I'm old enough to have lived through the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's amazing how little resistance, I'm not saying there wasn't resistance, but it's amazing how it was kind of like a house of cards and highly reversible. But anything that's self-organized is much harder to reverse. In fact, I mean, the penultimate chapter of Capital, Marx's Capital's testimony of that, because largely about how the expropriation of the communes, of communally owned land, how violent and difficult a process that was during the emergence of capitalism. So I think that one of the important things to keep in mind is, and one of the lessons of the Venezuelan process, is the centrality of, you could see even the primary nature of these kind of grassroots organization. Nevertheless, it's very important that it tends to hegemonize the whole society. And it's also important that it works to undermine and transform the state too. And one of the things that Mazares pointed out was, Mazares argued that the capital system was an organic system. And what does that mean? That means it's essentially a coherent system. It doesn't mean that it's not without contradictions. It has many contradictions. But as we know, we wake up every day, those of us who are workers, you wake up at the end of every day and they're workers and capitalists. You wake up at the end of the day, every day, and you discover the same, that you're also without means of production and you're forced to sell your labor force to someone else. And so capitalism manages to reproduce itself over time. And that's it's an organic, relatively coherent system. And part of that coherence has to do with the state. The state is part of that. It also reproduces certain state formations. And that also, one of the things that Mazares proposed, and he thought the communal system was a coherent alternative. He thought the burden of revolutionaries was to also propose a coherent alternative. He thought the Soviet system wasn't coherent because while it made some consent, it abolished private property, it abolished capitalists, it still had a top-down control of workers, it still had imposed production plans. Also, social democracy, which seems to be quite opposite from the Soviet system, actually shares a lot in common, has a lot in common. Both of them were kind of like hybrid systems, and those are not coherent. And history has shown, imagine how social democracy essentially imploded too in the 20th century and turned into an outright right-wing project. At the same time, the Soviet system also imploded or converted itself into a strictly capitalist system. One of the things that's important in maintaining, so that means that as one attempts to implement the communal system, one also has to have an eye on state. One also has to attempt to transform state power and keep in mind that Mazares said there's actually kind of like three legs of the capitalist system. One is capital, one is wage labor, and the other one is the state. And while the implementation of the new metabolism in the society at large, the grassroots implementation of a new substantially democratic metabolism was the primordial thing, it's also important to, on the one hand, I think there's essentially two options. One is you can take power and attempt to transform the state and make it a state that's more open to popular power. On the other hand, many people in many countries, there won't exist that option. People have to begin to build popular power, but then attempt to transform the state. That's necessary if one's going to create a coherent alternative. With that being said, Mazares believed, without espousing any kind of crude based superstructure determinism, he did believe that the essence of the transformation, the most essential transformation, would have to be the new social metabolism, the new forms of democracy and self-managed production and self-managed society more generally would be what ultimately abolishes the capitalist state and its state formations. You know, essentially a community council and the kinds of self-government that exist in communes, those are non-alienated forms of power, of even political power, maybe political power with a small p. And so the effort would be to abolish the state as we know it, which doesn't mean there might not be some kind of grassroots, there would have to be some kind of grassroots institutionality.
Certainly came through in my sort of observations of
the idea of abolishing the state
and how he operated. It was always this kind of trying to find ways to spark things that would spark sort of movements that could come up from below, whether it's supporting factory occupations or proliferating these like thousands of co-ops or trying to create the communal councils as sort of an alternate, and my understanding is what the intention was to create sort of an alternative form of state power that was rooted in these sort of like neighborhood discussions, as opposed to sort of a layer of elected representatives who are immediately sort of, co-opted by the sort of prevailing economic forces. I guess what I want to ask is like, how does that, how did that play out? Like, on the one hand, you have the incredibly ambitious idea of like basically doing away with the state as we know it and creating something completely unrecognizable based on solidaristic sort of social relations. So that's happening at the same time as you're trying to manage a petrostate. You know, we talked a bit about the theory, but how did the rubber meet the road? Like, what were the challenges in actually doing that? And I guess what were some of the accomplishments?
Well, I do think, I think that in a broad sense, one can say that I often contend that the most, that in Venezuela in the first decade of the 20th century, and one hopes extending beyond that, was the widest expression of the most, the broadest expression of popular power in the continent. I say that partly because I, like many people, I was very enthusiastic and I continued to be enthusiastic about Zapatismo. But Zapatismo renounced state power, and I know there are different tendencies within Zapatismo, and perhaps I am falling victim to some of the cruder simplifications of it. But I think that what the Venezuelan process showed is that by attempting to establish a dialectical relation with the state, you could actually expand popular power way beyond what had ever been done before in America, and that itself is a fascinating piece of data. Nevertheless, as you pointed out, it's rife with contradictions. And Alvaro García Linares, the former vice president of Bolivia, often refers to creative tensions. And I have to say that seems like a highly euphemistic way of describing things. I would say creative tensions also with a lot of collateral damage. But it is true that, you can say that, you know, Chavez's whole trajectory was marked by extraordinary experimentation, extraordinary levels of invention. I think that's one of the important legacies of the Bolivarian process, is that you can't, that there has to be a creative search that involves lots of self-criticism and in the process of finding a forms of emancipation. And I do think that you can see how Chavez did respond, or his government did respond to errors and did respond to directions that were essentially given to him from below. I mean, one example of that is this is kind of a forgotten chapter of Venezuelan history, partly because people in the process are not too enthusiastic about it because it was a kind of defeat. Chavez proposed a constitutional reform that was going to be, in some sense, put socialism in the constitution in 2007, and it was defeated. It was defeated. There's lots of elements. One thing is, I believe Chavez made an error in attempting to, there was a non-renovation of a television station's concession. And that was just a tiny thing, but a lot of the right-wing opposition managed to organize behind it. And that was early 2007. And then they kind of took that mobilization and managed to defeat the constitutional reform. But in response to that defeat, I think Chavez began to realize some of the importance of grassroots organization, that you couldn't just decree socialism. That and so he thought about how people could advance in a way that they would actually feel and see their successes rather than having kind of to take the whole package at once. And so I think in some ways the whole communal project and the set of laws that went along with that were an attempt to do that, and an attempt to build socialism in a more concrete sense rather than a more by fiat sense. Obviously the whole movement towards socialism has been dealt severe blows. The change of leadership was very difficult in itself, leaving aside whatever evaluation. I think it's important not to fall into personalistic evaluations. I think Nicolas Maduro would be the first to admit that he's not Chavez. One thing that people, anyone who knows anything about politics or power, even on a playground, will realize that when you arrive into power in a country where there's a weak institutionality, which is the case of almost all Latin American countries, possibly with the exception of Chile and Uruguay, then that means there will be inevitably lots of power struggles. So even maintaining power in that situation, leaving aside the various coup d'etats that the government faced, and Maduro's government faced, but there was also in a den of vipers as far as even internally, as far as rivalries within the Bolivarian process. So that itself was a very difficult thing. And then on top of that, for one thing, the global economic crisis affected Venezuela somewhat more late than other countries. So, you know, the global economic crisis hit the United States in 2007, 2008. But countries like Venezuela that are in global economy are primarily producers of raw materials. Those countries tend to be hit somewhat later, and that indeed was the case in Venezuela. And also his credit rating was cut down and through a probably almost certainly politically motivated decision. So there was a terrific economic problem. And then on top of that come sanctions. So certainly that was a blow to the movement towards socialism, and it also affected the masses too. I do not think that the government did everything as well as it could. I do think that there were many options that it took when it could have turned more to the people, and instead it turned away from them in critical moments. And those decisions were extremely unfortunate, and they lost a lot of people along the way. However, that's kind of history right now. I think that most of us in the process, we feel that it's important that the government stay there, the current government stay there, not as a bulwark against imperialism. And within that, bulwark against imperialism, the effort is to expand popular power. And that's an outright struggle in many cases. I think it's important not to downplay the importance of that struggle. Anyone who's been involved in organizing realizes that established power doesn't concede resources or freely. It needs lots of wooing at best, pressure, shaming. And for example, of Maicel Commune, the charismatic leader of it, Angel Prado, he's ended up being detained by the National Guard, at least on one occasion. And there's certainly a strong push and pull between the two poles. That I think is actually necessary to the organization, given the nature of the system. I mean, Esteban Macedo used to say that a socialist transformation was like rebuilding a house from within. And that's one of the things that points is that it's like extremely complex. And also you're dealing with lots of elements that are inherited from what you had before. You have lots of elements of the inherited state apparatus. And on the other side, on popular power, you have people who have been shaped by capitalism in itself, you know, so even their values and their horizon of expectations are in great measure shaped by the capitalist system. The most positive thing you can say about Commune, and I'm sure this is an important theme that goes throughout your different debates, is that one of the key challenges for any emancipatory project is the question of how you develop new people. How in a context that's highly determined by capitalism, unless you can go up to the mountain and get some tablets to tell you exactly what to do, which is essentially the idea of some utopian socialist, then there's only one real option, which is that people have to educate themselves. Marx himself in the thesis on Feuerbach and in his document Thesis on Feuerbach said that the educator has to be educated. So people need to find a process of self-education. And the communes in Venezuela, as is the case for a cooperative, any kind of self-managed situation, is a school for people to develop those new values. My friend and teacher, in some sense, Michael Lebowitz, he says that in a labor process, there's a second product of labor. And that second product of labor is the person herself who comes out of the labor process transformed. And that's all the more so if the labor process is under some kind of, is a self-governed labor process. So that's where the new can emerge, and the effort, and the one of the most important things of communal or self-organized labor, self-organized communal or cooperative situations, is that they can provide that kind of school in which the new beings can emerge, which also means that they're going to have to confront enormous contradictions in the society, in the state, in the general context that they're in.
So when you talk to people, you know, who are participating in these communes, what is their sort of viewpoint, or what are the range of viewpoints that you get when you talk to those folks, I guess, about whether it's the self-transformation or the collective transformation or the economic transformation or the relational transformation, like what's working and what isn't from their perspective?
Yeah, of course, anybody doing investigation has to account for some kind of principle by which you, I guess anyone, an anthropologist or even a revolutionary cadre, in the best case, will have to take into account their own position and the power they embody, even as a communicator, and wonder if they're being presented with an excessively rosy picture or some other motive is involved. Nevertheless, I think that, and so when I visit communes, I'm quite aware that people often try to present the best case forward, and probably the people who speak are the ones who are most satisfied. But one thing I can say, there's a couple things that make, I think that overwhelmingly the people I've encountered in communes are find the project gratifying and dignifying. I think there's some things that are probably important, and this goes back to where we began, saying how massive the project and its class basis, and the fact that it's taking place in a country in crisis. One is that, in a material sense, most people in communes live better than those that are not organized in a communal situation. And so in this extreme crisis, people have had the spur of necessity to find a new way of living, and that they found that in the communal situation. That means they have not only more dignity, but also often materially live better. Then I think that one thing that I've seen myself in many communal situations is that everyone knows that in most capitalist workplaces, people are stuck to their chair and doing one often dreary task over and over again. And the communes here do a good job of allowing people to learn about different processes and, in other words, move among different parts of the production process, breaking down the capitalist technical division of labor and thereby learning about the whole production process. So people grow as human beings. And then, of course, participation, as we were just saying, people grow as human beings, as more all around human beings. So I think that those are some of the things that I've seen with that a higher level of satisfaction. In fact, many people, you can say that people find the work process gratifying in many senses, which is a far cry from what you can see in most capitalist workplaces. And of course, dignity, right? People sense that they're part of something, even a historic, I think there's a widespread consciousness of here of people are engaged in a process of historic importance, of world historic importance. I think you can say that without exaggerating. So of course, giant contradictions. I have seen people who feel like, who actually want to throw in the towel, though they're the vast minority. And I find people who've been frustrated by the lack of support from the state. One of the big challenges of socialist construction that isn't a result that was discovered well before the Venezuelan process is the question of what was called one of the interesting developments in the Soviet Union was in the 1920s when they debated this question of what Preobrazhensky called primary socialist accumulation. And the idea was that Marx had thought of had thought that socialism would take place in developed countries that had already benefited from a important development of productive forces. But that wasn't the case of the Soviet Union. And so that caused Preobrazhensky and Bukharin to ask and give different responses to the question of how to get the resources to develop socialism, since socialism isn't about people living in poverty. And in Venezuela, there's that issue is playing out right now in some sense, because many people feel that, and I think they're completely right, think that the primary source of resources to modernize or technify production in the communes should be the state. The state has oil rents, even though they're severely cut back right now. But the state has oil rents, and it should direct a large portion of those oil rents to the communes. Then, in the absence of that, either for political reasons or scarcity of such resources, some communes, or almost all communes, also work through other means, even collaborations with capitalist producers in their region, an attempt to get the resources to expand and modernize their productive forms. I should say, probably most people aren't aware of the Preobrazhensky Bukharin debate. Bukharin, in some sense, was the architect or unconscious architect of the NEP, the new economic policy, which involved allowing capitalism to develop kind of small level capitalism in the country. And Preobrazhensky thought that what should be done is to expropriate campesinos and direct the resources towards industrial production that would be under state managed enterprises. I have to say that the terms are quite inverted right now. Neither one is immediately relevant to the Venezuelan situation, because the real question is not how you will direct resources from the state, but rather from it. And the direction is most often in towards rural campesino production. So, but perhaps some of the elements of that debate are still you can draw some lessons, because Preobrazhensky thought there was one clean solution and Bukharin thought there was a kind of messier approach, which
right.
I think many communes right now find themselves caught between those two possibilities and trying to do a little bit of both.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that. I mean, you wrote an article for Counterpunch I think it was last year, but describing the sort of, you know, very sort of grassroots sort of convergence of people from different communes all over Venezuela, and, you know, just describe people sort of riding in the back of trucks down bumpy roads, like, you know, covering themselves in dust to get to this place to like where the 500 people are like getting together and having a conversation as a movement of, you know, of communes. And I guess in that context, I'm curious what is the attitude of the Venezuelan state toward these communes? Are they basically just sort of letting them coast from the sort of previous era of, you know, Chavismo, or are they directing any resources to them? And I guess in parallel to that, like, what is the constituency within the sort of central, the centralized sort of national government for supporting that kind of effort? Like, is there still some kind of tendency or pockets of support for that, the more radical bottom-up socialism?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. I can go into some of the details of it, and I think I'm not sure if it will lose people because maybe some of the details of the changes in government here and the different attitudes aren't so relevant. But in a brief way, that was the what I referred to in the article was the attempt to build the Unión Comunera, the commune art union. That had been going on for some time, actually 3 or 4 years, and had been kind of partly interrupted, not entirely, by the pandemic. So, and that was when it was formalized. That was just about a year and a month ago, the Unión Comunera came to exist. And it's an attempt, perhaps the most ambitious attempt, to link communes, which is extremely important. Chavez said, as we've been saying all along, that these communes they're about hegemonizing the whole society. Chavez said, there's two quotes from Chavez you can take. One is, he said, a commune can't be an isolated commune is actually counter-revolutionary. That seems, perhaps he was going a bit too far, but he wanted to point out how if a commune is isolated it's and living in an ocean of capitalism, that's not going to work. And then he also said that a commune is like a cell. He often said it was a basic cell, but then he said a cell has to belong to a body. So the Unión Comunera still exists, to bring all those communes together, bring a great many communes together in a federation of communes of sorts that will attempt to grow and attempt to assert their power and attempt to obtain resources, but also establish routes of distribution among communes. It's extremely ambitious. I have to say that 1 year from the date, it has not made very much headway. Now, the state is a changing target, right? And one thing that had happened is that in great measure during the worst of the crisis would be from about 2016 to 2020, the state, or 2000, even even a little bit further, the state had pretty much turned its back on the communes. That doesn't mean there were some, as far as resources were concerned, but they really did not pay much attention to them under the pretext, which has some validity, that there weren't many resources. But there continued to be economic support from, there's something called Consejo Federal de Gobierno, and they continued to give some money to communes. I know that because they managed to deliver money to Maizal, to Che Guevara, and those were actually, that was actually important. The Ministry of Communes, there is a Ministry of Communes in the country, even though Chavez talked about how maybe it should be abolished, because the, with the idea that I think is totally valid, that communes are not the responsibility of one ministry, but they should be involved in the whole government should pay attention to communes. But the Ministry of Communes at that time was extremely passive, to say the least, at the time the Union Comunera was formed. Nevertheless, in the very moment that meeting took place, a new minister was put in place. And the new minister is more, has probably more of a mandate to assist communes. And some of his staff is quite interesting. One of his vice ministers comes from the popular movement. And the whole that's what changed the whole situation. So from the ministry, they've also started to develop efforts to link up communes. There's always been efforts on paper. There was something called forming communal blocks, but that was really just a thing more or less on paper. But now the ministry, under the leadership of one of the vice ministers, Hernan Vargas, has started to form communal circuits. And that's actually an interesting project. However, you can see then the very push and pull between grassroots organizing and the ministry, because then the ministry is forming these communal circuits. It has more resources. And of course, resources talk, money talks. And that's working. But again, I don't think the ministry, I think neither the ministry nor the government is the enemy. So if the ministry actually is able to help communes organize them, so much the better. It's a complicated push and pull. So right now you have a situation where the ministry is actually more sympathetic and more willing to lend a hand to popular power. And that part of the state actually has taken on a much more positive, sympathetic character. So that's kind of the changing battleground. It's rife with pitfalls and contradictions, because on the one hand, there's always a risk of course, one giant risk is that the communes will collapse from lack of resources, or people will, you know, abandon them because they can't even produce at levels that they need. But at the same time, there's a risk of people becoming excessively subordinated to the state, losing its autonomy. And certainly that you can see indexes of that, because as the communes began to be organized by the ministry, they ceased to rely less on connections between them. So it's a terrain of shifting sands, a very complicated terrain. Messero said that building socialism, the kind of socialist transition he proposed was harder. Messero said it, and Chavez repeated, he said it was harder than going to Mars. And I would add to that, it's also more valuable than going to Mars. So, and it's also probably a long-term process. You know, when I came here in 2006, I kind of thought the revolution was around the corner. And that's the way it felt. Things were very accelerated. And then there were moments of long years of these statements that Che Guevara said, I think Trotsky said it too, that in a revolution, the quotidian becomes extraordinary, the ordinary becomes extraordinary things happen every day. That's certainly something we felt. And when we arrived here, the whole pace of things and the pace of transformation, and then came decades of kind of doldrums and giant steps backward too. And right now you can see how the country in an economic sense is managing to raise its head once again, and people are living better. And so now there's the possibility to go forward. It's a new set of contradictions, a new contested terrain of struggle, in which during this economic recovery, which is limited and highly polarized, because I think it's more urban than rural, and it's more middle class than popular. But in the one of the key questions will be to whom, you know, who can benefit from this recovery, how the flow of resources will take place. Will the communes be able to go forward? You know, one of the ironies that probably is not too surprising is that in the very worst moment of the crisis around 2016, 2017, the most desperate moments are also one of the best movements for organizing here. People really had no other choice. No, that's not true. There are all kinds of their choices. You know, some people emigrated, But that was actually a moment when a lot of the best, you know, the most developed communes actually advanced. So now the question is, and I, you know, like if people want to look at an interesting book to that effect, I only encountered it recently. It's been around for more than 10 years, I think. It's Rebecca Solnit's A Paradise Built in Hell, where she shows how people kind of come together through mutual aid, build popular power in the most extreme crisis, contrary to what we're told. That's another fascinating part of it. And I've seen that with my own eyes here. But the other side of that is that when things start to get better, if there's not some kind of direction, if there's not some kind of conscious reflection on what's happened, that can be, a lot of those things can be reversed. So I think that one of the moments we're living through right now in Venezuela is, you know, people survive the worst of things, but can they survive a better situation? You know, can the relative abundance that's returning, can people continue to value the communal organizing, the sharing practices they establish in this new terrain?
It's great to hear. I mean, it's honestly a relief to hear that things are getting better, because you don't hear a lot of good news coming out of Venezuela. But I guess I just wanted to zoom in on that sort of 2017 moment for a second, because, you know, in another interview that I was watching the other day, you characterized the book that you put out as being a sort of a series of conversations with Venezuelans at the grassroots, and how their proposals for responding to the crisis really had to do with building the commune bigger and turning toward the people and really deepening the process of transformation. That and then you also, in a different part of the interview, characterized the sort of late Chavez and sort of Maduro administrations as having a sort of a rightward turn. So on the one hand, you have people at the grassroots sort of proposing to do more transformative, more from below, and then you have the government not doing that. Can you talk about the sort of context of the externally imposed crisis, how those political dynamics played out, and what was the sort of window of possibility of doing something differently, and what were some of the reasons that didn't happen?
Well, as far as the window of possibility, I mean, maybe I shouldn't focus on that too much. One of the things that I think that a lot of times when you live through a revolutionary process, you see lots of windows of possibility that were missed. Of course, what's the benefit of hindsight? The biggest window that I think everybody here is conscious of is that the right wing was totally they lost all credibility after the coup d'etat attempt and the oil sabotage. And Chavez could have advanced much more than he did. I think one of the problems that revolutionaries face is the question of risk. Nobody in political power likes risk. But if you think about it, you can't really do revolutionary transformation without assuming risks. And right now we're living in a very risky planetary situation. So I think it's a time for Venezuela, people worldwide to realize that you can't advance in a situation that's risk-free. And I think Chavez probably would have done better to rely on the people at that moment and try to advance more fully. Although, of course, I'm saying that with the benefit of hindsight. And the same thing with there's another curious moment in which the right wing was totally defeated here, and that's they started to do street protests. I think that there have been a number of moments in which they engaged in these violent street protests that are called guarimbas here. One was immediately after Maduro's first election, and then another intense moment was around 2016, and then the government called for a national constituent assembly. And at that moment, after the street protests had played out for more than half a year, and people were fed up with it, the masses of people, the majority of people were fed up with it, and the constituent assembly came in, the right wing just totally disappeared from the stage. And I think that Maduro could have advanced much more. Another even more tragic episode is that I generally think that following the death of Chavez and the whole crisis that emerged in the period of transition between the two governments, there was a turn away from the people, a lack of confidence in them. Now, it's true that when you turn to the people and you ask for them to defend you in the face of imperialism, that's a slightly risky project. But the alternative is to to rely on the state, and actually a state that can begin to show its repressive face in an economic crisis, because there's a kind of special police that were actually lethal in the battery of repressing poor people. I think that was a terrible, tragic mistake. Fortunately, that has ceased in a great measure. But so I think there were lots of missed opportunities in which the option was either to turn towards the known, the path of least resistance, which is relying on state actors, or turn to the people, which is somewhat risky, but in the longer term, it's really the only option for a revolution. And you risk alienating people, not only because they get, not only because they feel it in their flesh, but also you cease to communicate with them. They cease to understand what's going on. Like, I think there's something, Martha Harnacker talked about a pedagogy of limitations. I think that's something this process has done poorly with in general, not only with Maduro, but also with Chavez. I think Martha Harnacker directed it to Chavez, that you can't do everything at once. So it's better to explain to people what the limits of a process is at a given moment. Lenin actually was remarkable in that sense. He always said, you know, this thing is what we can do at the moment. Or, you know, for example, when there's a need to take a step back, he's called it a step back and didn't call it advancing. I think there's been a problem with that in this process, which has a lot of things to do with the media environment that is quite different from the time when Lenin lived. So that it's true that that was a terrible situation in around 2016, 17, going up to 2020. And one of the things that we encountered when we began to look at communes and interview people is we had really thought that it was kind of like a sense of like, where's the revolution gone? And one of the happy, that would be an understatement, one of the happy discoveries is that there really were people, true believers. There really were true believers. There are people who had totally understood the project. They just weren't the most visible ones in the country. And it was like time travel. It reminded me, actually, when we started to interview people, it reminded me of what I'd seen here in 2006, 2007. It reminded me of this situation where people were protagonists, and it wasn't only a sense of defiance faced with imperialism. It wasn't only a sense of loyalty to Chavez. It was all those things, but it was also, as anyone who has worked with the popular movement is, they actually had a plan. They actually had a strategy. They actually realized that the strategy would be to go forward and build a commune. It was a very interesting moment, and a lesson to me in the possibilities that exist in popular power. I think, you know, like, of course, theoretically, one understands this, you know, like, if you read E.P. Thompson, you realize that the working class is not some kind of generic thing that's spat out by the productive apparatus, but people develop their own plans. Well, I guess I had a front row seat on that. And the clarity with which people developed an idea of how to go forward is quite remarkable, impressive.
I just wanted to end with one sort of final question, specifically on the point that you just left on, which is, you know, what lessons do you think that, you know, more broadly, activists in North America or you know, in the global north in general can take from Venezuela's experience, specifically in terms of building alternatives to capitalism and the sort of role of self-managed production in that sort of process?
Well, I guess I mean I'd like to highlight one of the things that I think to be the basic lesson of what we call the communal path to socialism here, and this is basically a page from Esteban Mesaros, which is that the only way to overcome the organic capitalist system is to propose an organic alternative in a sense of a coherent alternative. In the 20th century, we saw incoherent hybrid alternatives and self-managed production with a horizon that goes beyond that, that attempts to overcome state power as well is a key element of that. To people in the global north, I also, in the Latin American context, given the trajectory of, you know, like you can see historical development between the Bolivarian process and Zapatismo, I think it's important to realize that that there was a learning process there, that it's one thing to build popular power, but popular power when it enters into a dialectical relationship with a partly transformed, that's the best you can do in a certain moment, a partly transformed state apparatus is a much more impressive and involves much more revolutionary potential. I guess another thing that I've seen with my own eyes is that a lot of communes here, the best ones, the most successful ones, have a certain relation to a vanguard. We haven't talked about that much, but for example, Panal, the most successful urban commune in the country, had a vanguard group, which is called the Colectivo here, which took on the organizing. But, and this is where the lesson comes in, like, these vanguards can be extremely important, and I think they're necessary, some kind of vanguard operation. After all, Chavez was a kind of vanguard, but he was a vanguard who was also like a cheerleader, you know? Like, I always think Chavez was like someone who tried to encourage people to do stuff. People often exaggerate the amount of power he had. After all, how can you make people assume a higher level of organization? Really, if you impose it on people, it's not a higher level of organization. The higher level of organization is a self-directed organization. So Chavez understood that. I always think that he, you know, he spent all that time on television essentially encouraging people to go forward, encouraging them to organize themselves. So I guess one other thing you can point here is the role of a certain kind of vanguard, but a vanguard that fosters popular power, because a vanguard that supplants popular power is a pyrrhic victory. You're killing the thing in the crib. So that's something one can see here, and it's an ongoing battle, because a lot of times even the Socialist Party here falls into that kind of error. But the vanguard that I've seen operate in the El Panal commune is a vanguard that has established this kind of positive, fostering, nurturing, dialectical relation. You can talk about like pedagogy of the oppressed. It's like, I refer to Paulo Freire, this attempt to allow people to emancipate themselves. You know, one other thing I think you could say, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. As anyone who's been in the left, you often hear this kind of Gramscian idea. It's not really Gramsci, to be fair to Gramsci, that he said pessimism of the spirit, optimism of action. I have to say that living here in Venezuela, I've had to totally revise that idea and basically throw it out, because you know, you can't really move forward with pessimism. Revolutions have to involve a whole person. They can't just involve the intellectual part of a person. They have to involve faith and hope and love, you know. And I guess I've seen that here play out in a big way.
Well, thanks so much, Chris, for taking the time. Do you want to tell people about your book or any forthcoming articles or anything else that people should check out?
Well, sure. People can. The book is a collaboration. I should say it's a collaboration between Ciro Pascual Martín and me. The book you mentioned, which came out in 2020, it's called The President's Struggle. It's an indirect reference to Che Guevara. He said, "La presente es la lucha." But it's, when I say we authored it, that's also an overstatement, because it's mostly a collection of interviews that we did, in which we discovered, you know, it was a tremendous learning experience to us. And one of the things that we learned was the importance of the commune, because the truth is we've been somewhat skeptical about communes until that point. So it was a project of self-education for us. Then you can find in Venezuela Analysis a number of ongoing interviews that are done by Ciro Pascual Martina and me. I found them fascinating. It's not because we did them, it's because people talked to us, said fascinating things to us. I've also written all my writing to date. Well, you mentioned the article in Counterpunch. There's two articles in Counterpunch. One that deals with the historical roots of the communes here, which is something we've kind of left out of the discussion here. And there's a second one which deals with the Communard Union. And then there's a number of essays or articles. Some of them are chronicles of visits to communes. One is about Esteban Mazaros and Chavez in Month's Review. They're all freely accessible in Month's Review. Finally, in October, I have a book that's coming out called Commune and Nothing, about the communes here.
You bury the lead there. That's very exciting. Well, thanks so much again for taking the time, Chris. And good stuff.
Thanks, Drew. It's been a pleasure talking with you.